From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Our unions have long argued the state cannot simply choose to violate the Constitution and diminish or impair retirement benefits if politicians find these commitments inconvenient to keep.
The basic argument that the legislature put forth is the Constitution has a strong protection of pensions. At the same time, the Constitution state law also provides for a lot of other requirements of state government, providing education, public welfare, health, and so forth. And that's the question that gets before the Supreme Court. At what point are the pension costs such a burden on the state government's ability to provide other services that some changes become allowable?
All of the evidence in the delegates' debate is to the contrary, that they fully intended to create a constitutional protection for pensions that could not be overridden.
My preference is probably to wait until the Supreme Court rules, so we have some ground rules for what probably works and what won't work. I think that's the smarter way to do it.
Comments from various folks involved in the court ruling at the circuit court level, ruling unconstitutional the Illinois pension overhaul. That final comment we heard, Governor-elect Bruce Rauner, who was among many, saying they want guidance from the Illinois Supreme Court on pensions. Follow-up on pensions among the topics today on State Week, and a look ahead to the fall veto session. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. At our Statehouse Bureau, Brian Mackey, WUIS and Illinois Issues. And our guest this week from the Associated Press, Carrie Lester. Carrie, thanks for stopping by today.
Thanks for having me on.
Last week, a circuit judge ruled the pension overhaul as unconstitutional. Lisa Madigan, the Attorney General, says she is going to ask them to expedite the ruling. And that is where we stand right now. And we'll give an overview again, Brian Mackey. Fairly plain and simple, a short ruling from the judge that said this overhaul was unconstitutional. It was unconstitutional for a reason that is stated in the Constitution.
Yeah, well, the Constitution says that membership in a government pension system in Illinois is a contractual right, and the benefits thereof shall not be diminished or impaired. I'm paraphrasing here. And the judge basically in Sangamon County said that means what it sounds like it means in the very plain language, and that is that you cannot diminish someone's pension benefits. And he ruled that the pension overhaul that was passed here in Illinois, that it's basically denying retirees and current employees their full benefits that they had been promised when they signed on. So, yeah, now it seems like it's definitely heading for an appeal at the Illinois Supreme Court, and we can, you know, talk about that too.
As with anything judicial, it is now all speculation from both sides. Carrie, just interested in what you've heard from both proponents of the legislation and those who are against it, or in reverse, those who support the ruling that it's unconstitutional, or those who think it should be upheld as constitutional?
Right. Well, Bill, obviously this was a huge win for the unions, but I feel like, as I'm sure you all feel like, we spent such a large portion of our lives covering the negotiations of the pension overhaul legislation that was passed by the legislature late last year around this time, that I really found it interesting to talk to members of that bipartisan pension panel that was formed and spent, you know, hours together hashing things out. Last Friday, I talked to Elaine Nekritz, Democratic state representative from Northbrook, after the ruling. And, you know, I said, how are you doing? I'm doing okay. I mean, this really became her life's work. And, you know, like many people, Nekritz was saying that, you know, it's too early and it's perhaps unwise to speculate what the Supreme Court might do. But in the chance that they uphold this ruling, she noted that the people who are paying taxes in 2045 will still be paying debts incurred in 2014. I know that, you know, we all chuckled at the governor's caricature of Squeezy the pension python. I think that's the brainchild of Claude Walker and his office. But Daniel Biss, who led into this segment, made an excellent point that we have to decide at what point the cost of pensions is more important than the cost of education and all these other services promised by the state.
Charlie Wheeler, that brings to mind, Biss made a comment in the remarks that we aired. He talked about education. Education is one of those that the state constitution says the state has should fund the preponderance of schools in Illinois, something to that effect. You'll be able to correct me accurately on that. And the Supreme Court in the past has not supported anything that would have required the state to guarantee a certain amount of state school
funding. Well, what the constitutional language says is that the state has the primary responsibility for providing this system of elementary and secondary education, high-quality education for every kid in Illinois. And the Supreme Court ruled in the early 1970s that is a goal and it's not enforceable. And in subsequent court rulings, they've said in their comments, I guess, in the dicta, I think is the technical term, that, our system of financing schools is really out of whack and it's horrible, but it's not our job to fix it. That's up to the General Assembly. It's a political thing. But the constitutional language that says the state has the primary responsibility for education, the heading of that section talks about it's a goal of the state to do certain things, to educate everybody to the extent of their capabilities. And so the court seized on that and said, well, this is a goal and it's not enforceable. We can't order the General Assembly to put more money into education. On the other hand, there's nothing in the Constitution that suggests that this pension guarantee is kind of a goal, or, oh, it's a nice thing that we should guarantee pensions if it doesn't interfere with our wanting to spend money on something else. And this argument about, oh, people are going to be paying in the future, whenever you borrow money, you wind up making payments over a long period of time. And the people who enjoy the capital projects that are paid for with bonded funds, some of them aren't going to be around when those final bonds are paid off. I mean, that's just the way it goes. And if you want to look at it from a historical perspective, for darn near a century, the state has been able to use money on education and healthcare and all those other goodies, in part by not putting aside enough money as was required to fund the pensions over time. So it's in my mind, it's in a way, it's okay. Tomorrow's taxpayers are going to have to pay for the freebie stuff that yesterday's taxpayers enjoyed for decades.
And that's really what it comes down to, doesn't it, Charlie? It's who is going to pay for the fact that the politicians and the people who elected those politicians again and again in Illinois, accepting that, oh, no, we don't need to raise your taxes higher. We can find other ways to pay for things. And some of those other ways they paid for things was shorting the payments they were supposed to be making into the pension systems. So really, that's the question here. Who should bear the brunt of those bad past decisions and make up for it? Should it be the state workers, university employees, downstate and suburban teachers, and I should add everyone but Carrie on this panel is a member of the state university retirement system. But, should they be the ones to pay for it, or should it be the taxpayers? There are other ways that you could make up this shortfall, as you've talked about many times in the past, and particularly on this idea of that, you know, we'll all be paying the debt in the future. I mean, money is fungible. I find that to be an interesting argument. I wonder if in some way you could say we're all still paying down the debt of the War of 1812, right? Because, I mean, the government is always spending money, is always bonding things, is always, you know, the federal government, the state government, like, you know, the balance, the actual idea that we have had a balanced budget is not something that we've had in quite a long time here in Illinois. And, you know, this is just yet another challenge to deal with.
Well, and it also occurs to me that you hear the number, and I think the most recent estimate is that the unfunded liability, the difference between what is expected to be there And what we're committed to pay is in the neighborhood of $111 billion. And somebody said, oh, well, if the state took all the money it takes in and its general funds for the next 3 years, it still wouldn't be $111 billion. The thing is, as I've said before and other people have pointed out, this is not money that has to be paid anytime soon in total. And it's the same as when you buy a house, you get a mortgage. For a lot of people, the amount of your mortgage is maybe greater than your annual income. But that does not mean that you can't buy a house. It means you make monthly payments over a period of 15, 20, maybe 30 years. And so you pay it off little by little. It doesn't all come due at the same time. It's the same thing with the pensions. All this money that we're behind does not come due at one given point in time. And if we ever to reach the situation that, the events in the world were such that all this money was due at once, we'd have a lot bigger problems to worry about than where does the money come from.
Because state government would be shutting down.
It would be the asteroid.
No longer a going concern, as they
say. For several years, I joked that the only way the state would not be able to meet its debt obligations would be if the Mayans were correct in terms of the calendar.
The bond houses did chime in a little bit this week. I wouldn't call it dramatic comments, but they did offer some statements.
That's right. I think Moody's said the ruling, if it was upheld by the Supreme Court, would speed the growth of debt for one of the worst funded pension systems in the nation. Standard and Poor's was a bit less reactive. They said that there was no short-term effect on the state's finances. So, I saw that as perhaps not as doom and gloom as it could be.
And we've seen all along from these rating agencies that they have said, even when this law was passed, that, well, we still have to wait and see if the courts will uphold it. Because I think, as you said last week, I mean, there has been doubt about the constitutionality of this law all along. We've even had the Senate president expressing his doubts, even as he, and some of his caucus members supported this legislation.
Well, and I'll say again, I'm repeating things I've said in the past, but I look at this bond rating agencies evaluating whether Illinois is a good credit risk or not. I think it's kind of bogus. And the reason I say that is there is absolutely no way the state is not going to repay its general obligation bonds. As a matter of fact, the General Obligation Bond Act specifically points out that the legislation creates an irrevocable and continuing appropriation of all the amounts needed to pay off the bonds. It includes, if there's not enough money in the road fund and the general funds, which are the basic source of repaying the bonds, then it says any other monies that the state have. Any revenue, any funds of the state have to be used to pay off the bonds. And it also says in another section, it says that the provisions of this section are irrepealable until all the bonds are paid in full, both principal and interest. So it's about as ironclad as you can get. So
what if there was a...
Go ahead.
I was just saying, what if there was a state emergency, Charlie? What if there was we have all these other priorities that we need to spend money on, like education and healthcare, as we heard from Senator Biss. Maybe we could just declare that invalid because there's a time of emergency.
Well, I suppose if you look at laws as being optional rather than when a law says the governor shall propose paying off the bonds as they're due, the legislature shall appropriate the money, and if for whatever reason that doesn't happen, then the money shall be transferred to pay the bonds. And not only that, you can't repeal this section until all the bonds are paid off. So that strikes me as there may be an emergency, but at this stands now, the bondholders have first claim. And I would argue that because of the Constitution, the pensioners have second claim on all the resources of the state.
Governor-elect Rauner said that he hopes the Illinois Supreme Court will give guidance on pensions. Rauner presuming that they will find it unconstitutional, but then offer up these suggestions. Charlie, you've been a little skeptical that the court will offer guidance.
Well, I don't like to dominate the conversation, but I can't recall in the time that I've been watching the Illinois Supreme Court that they've ever said, well, what you're trying to do is wrong, and so here's what you need to do. You have to do it this way, that way, or the other way, and here's a roadmap. If you do this stuff, then we'll uphold it. They're not in the business of giving guidance. They're in the business of ruling whether what the legislature passes and the governor signs, whether it's constitutional under the terms of our Constitution and the federal Constitution. It's not a question of them saying, oh, you got it wrong, and here's what you need to do. I mean, I'll go back to what I said about school funding. They said, yeah, the system is terrible, but it's not our job to tell you how to fix it.
Brian Mackey, you've covered the courts some through your career. Are you also one that agrees that the Illinois Supreme Court may not be the best source for advice?
Well, I agree with Charlie in the sense that, I mean, that's what he actually used this word earlier, dicta, right? Back to my first constitutional law class in college, they talked about when judges have dicta, and that's something that doesn't really address the merits of the case, and it's kind of a side statement. That's kind of frowned upon in the legal intelligentsia. And so, yeah, I do think it would be very unusual for the court to say, well, this plan doesn't work, but if you put everyone in a 401k, that would be okay, or something like that, which is, of course, what Bruce Rauner has proposed doing. I do think, though, that in one sense where I might differ a little bit from some of the criticism of people who are waiting for guidance from the court, if the court says, as the circuit court did here, this is unconstitutional, or if they say this is constitutional, that is guidance of a sort, then you know, well, okay, we can't be this harsh. Maybe we can have to go to a different model for trying to do something. And maybe that's either re-amortizing the debt, maybe it's pursuing a theory that's been advanced by the Senate Democrats called consideration, which looks more at the contract law, where you would offer the employee something in exchange for them agreeing to voluntarily reduce their benefits. And, you know, there are constitutional questions about that. Those won't be in this case that's before the court. So in the sense, no, I don't think the court will provide a roadmap, but merely by saying yes or no on the law that's passed, that is guidance of a form.
And also and they think, can't, go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry. I was just going to say from a purely political standpoint, I was going to say that I view this as a messaging issue with Rauner. He's studying everything. He's coming in. He's meeting with all these people who have been immersed in state government, and he's learning a lot of new things. So we've heard Governor Quinn in the past say that the court will give direction, but guidance just might be the wrong word choice here. I mean, I agree with Brian's point, and I think Rauner was trying to take the politically savvy step and just perhaps misstepped a little bit.
And it occurs to me, too, and maybe this is getting too much into conspiracy theory, it occurs to me that the people who drafted this legislation and passed it and the governor who signed it, they're all attorneys, they're all a lot smarter than I am. They know exactly what the Constitution says, but they're also in a position where they know what needs to be done to make this work is going to be painful. We're either going to have to raise revenues, cut spending, probably do both, and it's not going to be popular back home. So we throw up this Hail Mary deep in our hearts. We know that it's probably not going to fly. But then when the courts shoot it down, we can go to the voters and say, hey, we tried, and it was the Supreme Court. Or when they go to the editorial writers or the fat cat corporate execs who wanted to cut the pensions will say, well, we tried it your way, and the court said we can't do it, so it's not our fault. You know, it's a way to absolve the legislature from blame when they have to do the hard things that actually should have been done, you know, decades ago.
This is State Week in Review. Coming up, we look at the second week of the fall veto session just ahead.
Support for State Week in Review comes from Illinois Issues Magazine, a public affairs magazine deciphering Springfield legislation and the state of the state. The latest issue features the plight of young African-American males. Also, is Illinois facing a possible casino overload? Illinois Issues and its companion publication, The Roster of State Government Officials, is available at illinoisissues.uis.edu.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Carrie Lester of the Associated Press. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Illinois lawmakers back to Springfield next week. Carrie Lester, what do you expect to see happen or hear about?
Well, not a whole heck of a lot. I just filed a weekend piece, and in a nutshell, I think there's been a bit of a state of paralysis here, and I think part of that is the new governor-elect telling legislative leaders to wait to act on substantive issues. I think part of it is the outgoing governor losing political capital by the day, and I think those Democratic legislative leaders, Senate President John Cullerton and House Speaker Michael Madigan, they have strategies of their own. They're trying to feel this new guy out. So minimum wage is something that we have talked about and written about for months. And the state senator sponsoring the proposal, she introduced a modified bill that kind of would because in the veto session, not to get too procedurally wonky here, you need a 3/5 majority vote to have an immediate effective date. She pushed the start date back of the legislation, so it would only need a simple majority to pass. Now, Senate President John Cullerton says he has the support in his chamber, but House Speaker Madigan has been pretty noncommittal on the subject. Actually, I recently learned he wasn't even here during the first week of veto session. So his spokesman, Steve Brown, says he certainly plans to be here next week. But in terms of what else could come up, we are looking at the possible quick advancement of an election law bill that would make permanent the changes that we saw this last election that extended grace period voting and same-day registration, made it easier to vote on college campuses. Senator Don Herman is a sponsor of that and expects it to be pushed through pretty quickly. And on top of that, I'm certainly watching for a bill that would separate the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum from the Historic Preservation Agency. That's just this fascinating clash between the leaders of the two organizations, and Madigan actually stepped in the spring and tried to separate the two. The legislation didn't go anywhere in the Senate, and now he's reintroduced a proposal. Some lawmakers want to wait as a study is being completed on next steps and best practices, but Madigan's spokesman indicated to me that he doesn't want to necessarily wait. So I think we'll have some action next week, but there's a lot of speculation that the House could adjourn early. There could perhaps be no lame duck session early in January. I don't have confirmation of either of these, but it seems to be ending with more of a whimper than a bang.
I find it difficult to almost believe that they wouldn't come back for a lame duck session to take care of something, though.
I think that's true. I think we'll watch what happens with the minimum wage, but at the same time, we also have a very powerful leader of the House who doesn't show his cards. And so what they would be addressing in January at this point, I don't know. I sat down with Cullerton at the end of last week, and it's clearer than ever. They don't plan to take up the tax increase. He described it as with a little bit of snark in his voice, is giving the new governor-elect his first victory. So, you know, you're just looking at the list of items that are on the table, and you're wondering what else is out there.
And one other question. Go ahead, Brian.
I was just going to say, I mean, the appearances from the leaders, and you've talked to Senator President Cullerton, Carrie, but I mean, they seem to be playing nice to an extent with Governor-elect Rauner. They're not going out of their way to bash him in the press or anything like that. You know, I don't Don't know what they're saying behind closed doors to him, but they seem to be giving him at least a little leeway to come in. I mean, he made a lot of big promises during the campaign about, you know, lowering the tax rate and increasing spending in certain areas of government. And of course, you know, the bottom line of his campaign was shake up Springfield. And so I think that they are giving him a lot of rope, and they want to see what he does with it. Will he run with it? Will he trip on it? And you
will
know,
he hang
that
himself?
Seems to be the mode. I wasn't going to say that, Charlie. I'll let, let you have that.
I will. And Carrie, you said you thought Cullerton might have been a little snarky when he said that the first victory was, we're not going to increase the income tax for you so that you don't have to worry about it when you come in with your new budget in February.
I mean, anyone who has interacted with Cullerton knows he has that kind of jousting lawyer-like personality. You know, there's always a few double entendres. And so, yeah, I think that there was a little bit of sarcasm in his voice when he said that. And I think it's just, you know, you asked us to do this, Mr. Governor. You're going to have to step in and fix this mess come January 12th.
We'll get some notes from the field in now. I'll start with Charlie Wheeler.
The State Department of Natural Resource is beginning to accept permits for fracking, the controversial method of reaching gas and oil deposits that involves injecting huge amounts of water and chemicals underground to fracture shale rock and free up these trapped hydrocarbons. They began accepting applications after a judge in Southern Illinois refused to block the publication of the official rules and regulations. Some environmentalists had argued that the department did not follow the rulemaking procedure correctly, asked that the publication of the rules be stopped. The judge in Southern Illinois refused to do it, and so now we're moving ahead with the application process. The industry expects, though, that there won't be any actual production until the middle of next year or later.
We'll go to Carrie Lester now.
Mine's a little bit more lighthearted and stems from that aforementioned sit-down with Senate President Cullerton. He had met with the governor-elect and his new chief of staff, who has a, if you look at it on paper, a somewhat impronounceable last name, and we practiced it together. You say Mike Zolnarovich. So Mike Zolnarovich is a former deputy chief of staff with Mark Kirk, and I interacted with him there during my work at the Daily Herald before I came to the AP, but it took me a little while to get that name down, too.
That'll be a little harder for we broadcast folks than a print reporter, though, I must say. But I guess we learned Blagojevich down over time as well. Brian Mackey.
Yeah, I was reminded of a sort of notorious event in Chicago history on the night of Sunday, March 30th, 2003. The then mayor of Chicago, Mayor Daley, ordered the destruction of the Meigs Field runway. Some bulldozers were trucked in the night, and they carved giant X's, which is an aviation sign for do not land here. And that was his way of kind of forcing and winning the issue of what to do with the Meigs Airport along the Chicago lakefront. Well, thinking of that incident in the past, a group called Friends of the Park in Chicago filed a lawsuit asking a judge to prevent a similar sort of thing from happening to build the proposed George Lucas Museum in Chicago. The judge apparently asked the city lawyers to say that they would not cut into the land and start construction in the dark of night, but they would not give any guarantees.
So we'll be watching for that, possibly. That's our time for this edition of State Week. Special thanks to Carrie Lester of the Associated Press for joining us. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org, or you could search out State Week in Review on iTunes or iTunes U. Production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.